Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's an honor, and I want to thank Zurich Financial Services and the school here for inviting me and making this possible. I feel like I'm really here to rescue the reputation of the economics profession. For centuries, literally, we've been known as the dismal science. But yet, in recent years, I fear that climate scientists have overtaken us. Every week, there seems to be some new depressing revelation from the climate scientists out there. So I wanted to try to come up with something depressing from the economic side to try to kind of regain our glory in this regard. And I hope that you will agree with me that I've left you more depressed than you were when you came in. I want to take just a second to say a couple more words about the ERB Institute, which many of you are probably not familiar with. It's not an acronym for Environmentally Responsible Business. It's actually named after Fred and Barbara Erb. Fred was an alumnus from long, long ago and has been very generous with his financial support. And our educational product is a dual degree with an MBA and an MS, which allows students to come forth as former or future leaders in sustainable business. Our vision is really to be the leading source of research and education on how the natural environment, markets, government, and civil society shape and are shaped by the sustainability strategies of business. And our mission is to provide transformative tools, knowledge, and graduates to create an environmentally sustainable future. It's very consistent with what you folks are doing here at the Bren School, and I'm really looking forward to interacting with you over the next couple of weeks. So I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not going to talk about the science, but I did want to share with you a few photos just in case you haven't seen these already. These represent the work of a photographer named Gary Brosh, who has a wonderful project going on to document the effects of climate change. And he's using kind of a canary in the coal mine approach by looking at glaciers, which are one of the most visible places where we can see climate change happening. What he's done is identify old photos of glaciers and then go back to the same spot where the photo was taken and take a look at how that glacier looks today. Here's one from Alaska, taken in 1914, the Portage Glacier. So take a good look at that, fix it in your mind's eye, and then look for the glacier today. Here's a similar photo at the Pasteur's Glacier in Austria, taken in 1875. Fix it in your mind's eye, and we'll look for the glacier today. Completely gone. So if you had any doubts as to whether the world is warming, and I don't think people here do, these photos pretty well put them to rest. So I think that's just a nice way to start off our conversation, even though I'm not going to be going into the science at all. When we think about the drivers of what's happening, it's pretty well agreed that emissions of greenhouse gases, CO2 most prominently, are the most important source of this sudden increase in temperature that we're experiencing. This chart makes it really clear what you might call the world of offenders. It makes it very clear that the United States has made far and away the largest contribution to the warming we've experienced due to anthropogenic sources to date. You can see the EU is coming in second place, but that's a whole collection of countries involved. We stand proud in our unique position as an individual country. Now, of course, that has now shifted. China is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases today. They took that mantle from us, I think, last year. And going forward, of course, developing countries are expected to be the source of most of the increases in greenhouse gases over the course of the next century. Obviously, we are not going to solve the climate problem through a set of policies we impose in the United States alone. But we are going to need some actions. What are we currently doing as a planet to address climate change? Well, it's quite an amazing list if you look at it. There is the Kyoto Protocol, ratified by 141 countries. It has targets for only 39 of those. It has led to the creation of the European Union's Emission Trading System, which I want to discuss further in a few minutes, and created something called the Clean Development Mechanism that allows developing countries to participate. We have now a series of state and regional greenhouse gas caps. You folks here in California leading the way in a lot of respects with AB 32. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the northeast of the U.S. is following along in a similar path. There are a variety of renewable energy programs throughout the world. Germany's feed-in tariffs are well known, allow renewable energy producers to receive very high prices, which has greatly stimulated the marketplace there in Germany. Many states in the U.S. have renewable portfolio standards. I will talk more about those in a few minutes. Those things create renewable energy credits, which has led to the creation of a series of balkanized REC markets throughout the United States. There's a low-carbon fuel standard in California. There may well be one in the rest of the U.S. before long. The Carbon Disclosure Project is an effort by a group of institutional investors with more than $57 trillion in assets, pressuring companies to create plans to deal with climate change. Regulators are decoupling electricity sales from profits so that companies don't have incentives to increase their use of electricity and increase the climate impact of that. We have a variety of subsidies in place already, production tax credit, R&D subsidies, and tax credits for purchasing plug-in hybrid vehicles. More of those are forthcoming. NGOs are active with a variety of climate programs, including WWF's Climate Savers Program and the Rainforest Action Network's No New Coal campaign, very different approaches to addressing a similar issue. And there are a number of voluntary carbon markets springing up. There's the Chicago Climate Exchange. There is now an emerging market for avoided deforestation credits. It's nascent, but it's developing very rapidly. And there are markets for voluntary renewable energy credits, in addition to the mandatory ones that come through renewable portfolio standards. So there is quite a collection of different policies out there. That all sounds good. We haven't gotten to the depressing part yet. If you think about the Congress, it's usually a depressing topic. But last year, they considered a variety of bills. I guess considered is probably too strong a term. They had introduced a variety of bills. You can see they take various forms. What the Obama plan proposes to do is going to follow the most stringent of those associated with Boxer and Waxman, the California version of these bills, if the administration does go forward and propose such policy. And then if you look in greater detail, and I promise not to read all the things on this slide, if you look in greater detail at what is contained in the Obama Energy Plan, it's quite an amazing list of things. You can read them for yourselves. We don't really even have time to let you do that. I just want to put these up here to give you a sense of the great variety and breadth of actions that the administration proposes to take. So can you see the whole in that collection of individual bits and pieces? There are many, many bits and pieces there. Can you see on the left a guitar player, as Picasso saw it? Can you see on the right a woman with guitar, as George Brock saw things? Or does it look like just a bunch of bits and pieces thrown on a canvas? And even more importantly, is the whole greater than the sum of the parts, or is it possibly less than the sum of the parts? That's the question I really want to explore today. Now, before we go deeper into that collection of parts, I want to raise the question, this very important terminological question, of what do we call this collection of bits and pieces? And really, this was an exercise that I wanted to undertake because of my grandmother. My grandmother was a woman who loved words, she loved crossword puzzles, she loved poetry, and when I was a kid, she gave me this delightful book called An Exaltation of Larks. It's a book of venery, and no, that's not, it's not a gutter term. It refers to the use of collective nouns for groups of birds and other animals. So if you have a group of larks, they are an exaltation of larks, which is quite wonderful. If we have a group of seagulls, we call them a flock of seagulls. If we have a group of horses, we call them a herd of horses, and that's also quite wonderful. If we have a group of locusts, however, we call them a plague of locusts. And if we have a group of crows, they're actually called a murder of crows. So when you think about a collection of bits and pieces of policy, you have the question, what should we call it? Say, something of policies. So I thought about a whole collection of possible terms, some of them nicer than others. So maybe the obvious one is a patchwork of policies, but that's too familiar. What about a squabble of policies? Or maybe a pottage of policies, or a rumpus of policies. There are lots and lots of different possibilities. I ended up with one that was fairly polite, a pastiche of policies, which means a medley of various ingredients, a hodgepodge, a farrago, or a jumble. It also means an artistic, literary, or musical work that's composed of a collection of pieces from hither and yon, not necessarily assembled with any great coherence to them. Well, I think what we have in the policy domain with regard to climate change is exactly that. It's a pastiche of bits and pieces put together in a way that may or may not come together in the way we hope. Now, economic theory actually has some fairly simple and straightforward recommendations when it comes to policy for climate change. First of all, put a price on carbon. You could do it through a carbon tax. You could do it through a cap and trade system. They're roughly equivalent, although there are subtle differences. Most economists would argue a carbon tax is going to be significantly more efficient, but politically, we're not likely to go in that direction. That's going to be a constant theme throughout the rest of what I want to say today. Secondly, we should support basic R&D, fundamental kinds of science and engineering research that the marketplace is not likely to do on its own. Thirdly, we should promote learning about new technologies. When companies bring forth new types of wind turbines, new solar cells, there's a learning curve involved, often a very important one. Companies can't capture all the benefits of the learning that they encounter as they move down that learning curve. There are social benefits that go beyond what individual companies can capture. Therefore, society has a good reason to encourage more learning than the market would do on its own, and something like the production tax credit finds solid grounding in economic theory. Finally, there are a variety of shortcomings of information in the marketplace, certainly around energy efficiency. We've had an energy efficiency paradox for over 30 years now, where people wonder, why don't consumers purchase more energy efficiency? And we have a variety of answers for that. Often they're not well informed. Sometimes they're myopic. Sometimes they face agency problems of a variety of forms, so that a landlord doesn't have incentives to make a home efficient for somebody that's renting from him, or a builder doesn't have incentives to make a house efficient for someone who's buying that from them if they can't credibly document what they did to make an efficient home. So there are a variety of information failures that occur in the energy efficiency marketplace, and we ought to fix those. So economic theory is very helpful for giving us a fairly clear and simple set of recommendations for policy. Do these look like that long list of policies I showed you before? Not really. They have some resemblances, but there are an awful lot of other things involved in our list of actual policies. Well, what gets in the way between doing what we think is the correct thing from a policy perspective and doing what we really do? Well, one, we lack an international governance system. Pretty well recognized. International law, for the most part, doesn't exist. We're in the process of building it, but it's a very slow process. Secondly, and worrisomely, there's growing protectionism at both the national level and, to me, even more bizarrely, at the state level within the United States. So we're starting to see a move toward, I don't know that you could call it a Smoot-Hawley type of set of tariffs that helped to lead to the Great Depression, But we're starting to see a real lurch toward protectionism in a lot of places that I think is setting us up to pass some poor quality policies. I mean, you don't have to look much further than corn ethanol to have an idea of the kinds of policies you can put in place if you're not keeping your eye firmly on the ball. And that leads to the third potential piece of gum in the works, that is rent-seeking by interested parties. Now, when it comes to climate change, the big three have been coal, oil, and automobiles. And, you know, I come from Michigan now, but I have to admit that the automobile sector has spent an awful lot of time and effort lobbying against policies that would help deal with climate change. And you folks here in California are very familiar with some of those. The auto industry lobbied heavily to prevent CARB from having authority to regulate tailpipe emissions. One of the first things Obama did when he took office was to change that and authorize EPA and CARB to move forward with regulating CO2 emissions from tailpipes. Now, we think of the big, bad, dirty guys as being involved in a lot of lobbying activity, but the good, small, nice, clean guys also get involved in plenty of lobbying, and the larger they get, the better they will get at that, the stronger they will be and more effective at it, and that doesn't guarantee we get good results. So we've got a variety of things that get in the way between what economists have long recommended we should do and what we actually end up doing on the ground. So you can see the depressing part of the talk starting to creep in. So those of you who are economists will be very familiar with this notion of what we call the second best, but those of you who aren't may need a quick refresher. The general theorem of the second best was enunciated by Lipsey and Lancaster back in 1956, and they showed this very disturbing thing, that if we fail to get in place all of the conditions we need for perfect competition to work well, then there's no guarantee we want the rest of the conditions to hold. It's almost as if we go back to the drawing board, we have to start from ground zero and ask complex questions about what's the right mix of policies. If we can't do the best thing, what exactly does the second best thing look like? Or the third best, or in many cases in the political world, the nth best. Especially when it comes to energy-related policy, there's always a huge number of interest groups waiting on the sidelines to impose additional constraints on doing the right thing. This is where things get really depressing, because we're quite sure that political forces will stop us from doing precisely the right thing, which means it's very hard to tell what we ought to be doing when we fall into this world of the second best. I want to give you just a simple example. Again, my friend sitting here in the front row are not going to learn anything, but folks that may not be as familiar with the theory of the second best may benefit from a simple example. Consider an example of a perfectly competitive industry. Lots of small firms busy making stuff people want to buy, but it has the unfortunate feature that there are environmental externalities associated with it. Well, what's the first best thing to do? Economists have long advocated that what we need in that case is an environmental tax that measures the impact of those external effects on third parties and internalizes them through imposing a tax. Very well understood. Of course, you understand perfectly well that a tax in the United States is a four-letter word, so we don't necessarily get an environmental tax. Which raises the question, suppose rent-seeking by some affected industry blocks us from imposing an environmental tax. Now what's the second best thing to do? And it raises the very odd question, should we change antitrust policy in order to improve the environment? Not an obvious thing to do unless you've been schooled in economics. So should antitrust policy continue to maintain competition in this industry? And the answer is not at all obvious. Environmentalists tend to like monopolists in some sense, because a monopolist wants to restrict output. Now, he raises prices and makes more money, but the environmental impact is to reduce environmental burdens on the environment. So when we are unable to pass an environmental tax that we want, we may then also be led to relax antitrust policy as a second best way of getting at the policy we need. Given how counterintuitive that is, it's not surprising that once we get into this world of the second best, the pastiche of policies that we have may be very, very difficult to evaluate. So I want to give you a specific example, borrowing on the work of some colleagues, Ian Perry at Resources for the Future, Robertson Williams, and Larry Goulder up the road at Stanford. And they asked the question, when can carbon policies actually increase welfare? And they're not questioning the fact that there's climate change and that we ought to deal with it. They're asking the question, does the world of the second best so deeply undermine our efforts that we can't impose a useful policy? They recognized that we live in a world where we've already got a distorted marketplace with, in this case, income taxes, distorting people's effort. So you work less hard than you would if you got to take home all the money that you earn. And given that circumstance, they recognize two effects from imposing carbon policies. First of all, there's what they call a tax interaction effect. What that means is that when we impose a carbon tax or a cap and trade system, we will raise the price of energy using goods and services. That interacts with the pre-existing tax on income to cause prices to rise even further. It reduces real wages and discourages people from working. This is going to be particularly true in a weak economy such as we're currently facing. So that's one effect, is to exacerbate the disincentives caused by the existing tax system. Secondly, there's a more positive effect. There's what they call the revenue recycling effect, which means if you auction off the permits, you can use them to reduce income taxes, as Al Gore has been proposing. It's a great thing to do. Doesn't mean we'll necessarily do it. So we've got these two conflicting, potentially conflicting effects, and they turn out to have really important impacts on what policy can actually accomplish. So I want to just point to the graph that summarizes all of this stuff. And I know showing a complicated graph to a large audience can be a problem, but I think this really illustrates an important point. What you've got on the horizontal axis here is marginal damages from emissions of greenhouse gases. So it's measured in terms of dollars per ton of carbon emitted. So every time we burn more coal, emit more CO2 into the atmosphere, it creates social damages. And this axis is telling us, here are the possible magnitudes of those damages. We don't know for sure what the damages are, which is why we allow for different possibilities on that axis. On the vertical axis is the net social benefit from imposing what economists call the Pigouvian level of regulation. Pigou was the first economist to suggest we need to internalize externalities through an environmental tax. So that axis is saying, if you go out and try to do the right thing, try to set the right environmental tax or the right cap and trade system, what are the benefits we're going to get? So those are the two dimensions we're looking at. And then you'll notice there are three curves on there. The top one says, here are the social benefits if we had a carbon tax or a quota. So by quota, we mean a quantity constraining system that's equivalent to a cap and trade when you don't auction off permits. So as you're probably well aware, whether or not we auction permits in a CO2 constraining system is a big political deal. The Obama administration has been very forthright in saying they want to auction them off. That's not normally what we do with permits. We usually give them away for free for political reasons. But what that first chart or first line on the chart shows you, the one at the top, is the social benefits from a world when we impose the carbon tax or a cap and there's no distorting income tax. In that world, the two things are equivalent and they produce substantial benefits. The next curve below that is the social benefits of a carbon tax when we have in place a pre-existing income tax, which distorts work effort. And basically what we get is doesn't produce as much of a benefit as you'd like, but it's still positive for any value of marginal damages. So the kicker, the thing I want you to notice here, is this region on the third curve. That third curve looks at what are the benefits if we impose a carbon cap and trade system but give away the permits rather than auctioning them off. And what you want to notice there at the bottom is there is a wide range where imposing the cap and trade actually makes us worse off overall from a social perspective. So yes, it produces some benefits in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but it has such a distorting effect on the economy because we give these things away for free and it amplifies existing income tax distortions that we would have been better off doing nothing. So they ask the question, when can carbon policies accomplish anything useful? And that range down there is the case where we can't accomplish anything useful because political forces cause us to give away the permits for free and wouldn't allow us to pass a carbon tax. So we're getting thoroughly into the depressing part of the talk now. We may be unable to pass a bill that actually makes things better. Disheartening. I want to talk about three specific policies in a little more detail. First of all, the Kyoto Protocol and the EU's emission trading system, which came out of it. Secondly, renewable portfolio standards in the United States. And thirdly, green electricity programs and how they interact with other programs for pollution control. And we'll take SO2 as the example. So the EU ETS, as a place to start, was created once the EU ratified the Kyoto Protocol. The trading system was put in place in January 2005. The trading market covers 12,000 large factories and power plants. Still, they're only responsible for a little under half of all CO2 emissions and about a third of total greenhouse gas emissions. But then that was done basically because it's very hard to get your arms around all the small and mobile sources. So they started with the large sources that are easy to monitor. They then went through a process of negotiating allowances across the 15 countries that had joined before May 2004. And you'll note 95% of the permits were given away for free. That's usually what happens in cap and trade systems, just due to political pressures on the part of industries that are going to be regulated. Now, to their credit, they did set up a good system of penalties to try to ensure that companies actually comply with the system. So there are two comments to make before I go to the next picture. And the first is that this is exactly the kind of situation that Perry et al. Were looking at, where we might not be getting a welfare improvement depending on marginal impacts of carbon regulation. But secondly, what actually happened when the EU implemented this was rather perverse. So what this chart shows you is price paths for forward contracts on the CO2 emission allowance market. And you'll see a couple of different colors on there, and focusing on the red and the blue. So the red are for the first phase of the emission trading system, 2005 through 2007. The blue are for forwards of the year 2008, which moves into the second phase. And, of course, the interesting thing is the unbelievable crash in the red line. So we had a period where carbon prices were fairly stable in the range of 20 euros per ton of CO2. And then you'll notice they crashed to a value of zero. They became worthless. Now, what happened there is a little bit unclear. People can take different views about it. In the end, the EU had allocated more permits than there were emissions. So the cap was absolutely non-binding, and as a result, it had no impact. The prices of these permits had zero value because the EU had simply given out way too many of them. So we've got a situation where it's possible, not that I can prove it, but it's possible that this was a world where carbon cap was not going to produce a social benefit, and it was done in such a way that it was an enormous handout to industry. So industry got tons and tons of free permits, cashed them in for 20 euros a ton, went home to the bank, and it turned out that it had absolutely no impact on emissions. So, you know, I have sometimes in the past been a little too direct in suggesting what I think went on. Was this simply a case where industry pulled the wool over the eyes of regulators? Or was it really the case that industry didn't know their own emissions levels? It's probably some combination of the two, and maybe future research will uncover exactly what happened there. But the bottom line was that we had a policy system that ended up being so poorly designed that it had no impact at all. Now, that's been changed, and as you can see, the blue graph shows that prices going forward now do have value. So we live and learn, we make some mistakes early on, and hopefully we get it right the second time. I want to turn now to renewable portfolio standards. An alternative policy doesn't create a cap and trade on carbon, but it's meant to increase the use of renewable electricity in the United States. And these have been done at the state level so far, not at the federal level, although the Obama administration wants to pass a federal RPS. Many of you have probably seen this chart. There's a wonderful database online, DSIRE.org, D-S-I-R-E, and they have a lot of information on the various kinds of policies that states have put in place in the U.S. So as you can see, 29 states, I think it may be up to 30 now with Michigan, plus the District of Columbia, have adopted renewable portfolio standards. So we're getting close to this being the norm in the United States. And you will see as you look at them that they vary enormously in terms of the stringency and the timing when they come online. There's been something of a momentum building in adopting these things. The early ones, actually Iowa's not even on here because it was so much earlier than the rest. But we had a spate of early adopters in the late 1990s, and then you can see it's really ramped up over the last few years. And this is just listing the various states and when they came online. A little more ominous, to me anyway, is that many states impose some sort of in-state requirements. So they give stronger preference to supplies that are produced within their own state boundaries over power that's produced outside of the state. So in some states, you get an extra credit for producing power within the state. In states like North Carolina and Virginia, you're not allowed to use more than a certain amount of power from outside the state. So it very much is a form of domestic protectionism. It's not entirely clear to me why the Interstate Commerce Clause doesn't prohibit this kind of stuff, but nobody has brought an ICC charge. So we've got a lot of states starting to act as protectionists, even within our own country. And it's an interesting puzzle because, again, economists are able to shed some light on whether this is a good policy, and the answer is, not really. Dallas Bertrand and Karen Palmer have a very nice paper they've done looking at RPSs as a policy measure. They use a model that they've developed at Resources for the Future, and their key findings are an RPS raises electricity prices. That's okay because we're getting a benefit. We're phasing out fossil fuels. But it primarily displaces natural gas. What you want it to do is displace coal, because coal is the dirtier source. The RPS is not as cost-effective as a cap-and-trade for reducing carbon emissions because it goes after the wrong source. Natural gas is the marginal source on a lot of utility systems, and that's what gets displaced by renewable power from the RPS. So this is not the first best policy, which raises the question, why are states doing it? In some work I've been doing with Haitao Yin, I've tried to study the factors driving states to adopt RPSs. And it turns out the most important ones are the following. Most important single thing, strong democratic representation in the state legislature. So as has become abundantly clear in the last 2 weeks, this is not a bipartisan world. RPSs remain a largely democratic tool. The second most important thing is the presence of a staffed chapter of the American Solar Energy Society. So could that be rent-seeking on the part of our good friends who are trying to do the right thing? It looks like it. Now, it's comforting to see that at least strong wind potential matters in passing an RPS. It should obviously be very important, and it is. Now, one of the things you often hear about RPSs, and certainly in Michigan this was bandied about extensively, an RPS will create new jobs. We hear a lot about green jobs nowadays, and an RPS is alleged to create green jobs. Well, that means, you would think, states with high unemployment rates would be the ones beating down the doors to pass an RPS so they can create new green jobs. It turns out it's actually the opposite. It's states with low unemployment rates that are willing to pass RPSs. So despite the rhetoric, it seems like when push comes to shove, politicians don't buy the rhetoric about green jobs. And high unemployment rates are not driving the passage of these things. So it's much more of a straightforward partisan political process with lobbying in the back. States are more likely to impose in-state requirements if they have currently little renewable supply and they've restructured their electricity markets. So this is, again, consistent with the notion that states want to ramp up, try to become the leaders in producing various forms of renewable energy. Michigan wants to be the leader in plug-in electric vehicles. Of course, so does Indiana, so does California, so does probably most every other state in the country. So it's easy to picture a world where we start racing to try to be the first movers in an industry where really you can only have one first mover. So to me, this is symptomatic of a blurring line between environmental protection and environmental protectionism. Increasingly, we see states or nations trying to create leadership positions in the green economy using protectionist tools. The RPS with in-state requirements is just one. You start to see states bidding for manufacturing capacity for things like wind turbines, solar energy, lithium-ion batteries, and we have a chance of getting into a traditional old bidding problem where states bid beyond the value of what the industry is actually going to create in their state, and they essentially end up paying that all out in the form of bribes for industry to come. We also end up with a situation where some countries, Germany most notably, impose feed-in tariffs that are extremely costly. They're paying 50 cents a kilowatt hour for solar power in Germany. Most Americans don't want to pay 50 cents a kilowatt hour. When your bill says 10 to 13 cents a kilowatt hour, we think that's high enough. So some countries are paying very high prices for renewable power, in part with the hopes of creating an industry that will then lead in world manufacturing. So we're moving, in some ways, back to a mercantilist era of using policy to create new industry. In some sense, this follows upon the so-called Porter hypothesis, which Michael Porter tossed off in a science article a number of years ago, where he argued that if we regulate the heck out of ourselves, we'll get richer. Most economists thought that was counterintuitive. But you can imagine a coherent story for that hypothesis in which if you're the first country to impose environmental regulations and you build up an industry domestically, that industry is then poised to take the lead as other countries around the world impose similar regulations. However, if everybody's doing the same thing, you can't all be first movers, and this notion of a Porter hypothesis benefit goes out the window. We could easily get into a world where we have a subsidy race that ends up creating lots of excess capacity, maybe even for things that we conclude later on are not desirable, such as corn ethanol plants. And it turns out corn ethanol plants are in excess supply now. They're being shut down because way too many of them were built. The other thing we get here is that it undermines the creation of an integrated national or international market for renewable power. In the United States, we have a lot of wind energy in the Great Plains, but not a lot of people living there. What would make a lot of sense is to build some transmission so that we can connect that Great Plains power to Chicago and other areas that need it. But when we have a state-by-state approach, we have states that will try to veto that. In particular, in the United States, the Southeast is deeply opposed to a national-level renewable portfolio standard because they think they will have to pay more for clean energy from the Great Plains than they have to pay for dirty coal that they currently use. So this protectionism is really setting up opportunities to make some very bad policy choices. Finally, I want to point to what happens when we get overlapping policies. I used to think that this proliferation of state and local policies was going to be subsumed into coherent national policy once we finally got on board and put a cap and trade in place. I'm no longer so sanguine about that. I think we will continue to have a variety of state and local measures that go above and beyond what the feds do, which means that we have to really understand how these overlapping policies interact. And I want to point to one specific example on green electricity and sulfur dioxide. We think green electricity programs should reduce pollutants of all sorts, including SOx, NOx, mercury emissions, and greenhouse gases. And this would be especially true if green power backs out coal instead of natural gas. However, the sulfur dioxide market is already regulated, and if regulators fail to take into account the way new green electricity programs come online, they may fail to achieve the desired result. In particular, if we get a lot of green electricity in, say, California, then utilities with sulfur dioxide permits can simply sell them to people in other states who can choose to emit their sulfur dioxide elsewhere, leaving the aggregate national level of SOx emissions the same. So with multiple policies in place, we need to think carefully about the interactions and connections between them, or we may fail to get the desired environmental benefits. So in research that the Urban Institute has funded, Professor Michael Moore at the School of Natural Resources and Environment, along with one of our former postdocs, Jeff Lewis, has studied the interaction of these permit markets. And they ask the question whether, in practice, green electricity sales are resulting in the retirement of more SO2 permits. So I want to just show you their results for Pacific Gas and Electric Company, which is where they started in looking at these comparisons. So what they've done here is, for a series of 5 years, looked at the net generation by PG&E, what were the number of sulfur dioxide allowances they had, and created a measure of total generation per allowance, so megawatt hours per ton of sulfur dioxide. They then asked the question, how large were green electricity sales? So you see that in the next column. You can then back out how many additional sulfur dioxide allowances should be retired if green electricity was actually displacing sulfur dioxide creating fossil fuels. And then they get the column with the green header. Here's how many allowances we think should be retired. What does it mean to retire them instead of selling them to somebody else? You just sit on them. You hold them in place and don't use them. They then look at PG&E's sulfur dioxide account to see how many were they really sitting on and holding. You'll notice the numbers are not equal. PG&E is selling most of those, apparently, onto the market, which means that sulfur dioxide is simply being emitted in another state rather than in California, but that isn't really helping anybody. So I've given you three sad tales of policy gone awry trying to recover from the climate scientists our role as the dismal science, and trying to illustrate the importance of understanding these policy interactions. We social scientists are pretty good at recommending what makes sense as a first best policy. When we fall off into the world of second best policies due to political constraints, it's a much more treacherous terrain, much more difficult to assess what really is the nth best kind of result. So although the politics of climate change have changed dramatically in the last 3 years, and that's a great thing, we in the US badly needed that change, we're not likely, in my view, to impose a set of first-best policies. Instead, political realities mean we will get a pastiche of policies, a medley of unconnected, uncoordinated bits and pieces, which may or may not add up to more than the sum of the parts. And I would end with a plea for more work in this area. Folks at the Bren School are perfectly positioned to do this kind of work, helping us understand what policies will actually help to solve our problems and which ones will merely create a mess. So I apologize for going over time. I realize it's close to 1:30 and we have less time for questions than I would have liked, but I thank you for your attention.
Tom, you were emphasizing the role of politics and rent-seeking, sort of causing a lot of these what otherwise would seem to be desirable policies to turn out in less desirable ways. And I'm wondering, and you also talked about the importance of auctioning off these emission permits in order to get really to remove some of the distortive effects of income taxes. I was just wondering what political model you had in mind that would, if we auction off and raise those hundreds of billions of dollars, why we wouldn't think that those dollars would go also in various rent-seeking ways instead of to these reducing income taxes.
Well, I thought what Al Gore was proposing made perfect sense. You want to pass a bill that ties things together right from the get-go. So you pass it and say, we're going to use this to reduce income taxes or cut payroll taxes and pass that directly through to people. Because nobody trusts politicians to do the right thing later. So you need to make sure the bill, when it's passed, does it at the outset.
Hi, I have a question about the EU ETS as well. I think even for this second time period, starting in 2008, they didn't auction the permits, even though they learned, you know, of what happened as a result. Why do you think that is?
Politics are very powerful. And in some sense, the more important thing was to get the quantity of permits corrected, so to tighten up that cap, because when the cap doesn't bind, it does nothing whatsoever. In my mind, the auction versus non-auction issue is secondary to at least getting some reductions in place. But the political power of industries that are going to be affected is always very significant. And that's why historically there's not a lot of examples of pure auctions for environmental permits.
One of the things I'm working on currently is a protocol for the electric power sector to report their greenhouse gas emissions with the Climate Registry. And the Climate Registry says that it's a policy-neutral organization, but in developing the protocol, it's remarkably difficult to set the measurement tools that are truly policy-neutral. It's been very interesting to see you give these examples about the RPS standard, and we've been involved with the renewable energy industry who want to allow the electric utilities to get credit in their metrics for the renewables that they're buying. So I think that what I could take away from that is the the extreme importance of really trying to have these measurement tools that allow us to make good decisions without being too negatively influenced by the policies that can contaminate them if you're not very careful about how you do it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't know the details of that particular climate measurement system. Utilities are in some sense the easy case because for the most part it's carbon in, carbon out. You can measure what types of different fuels the electric utility is using and do a pretty good calculation of what climate impact they have. Other sectors are much more difficult to do that for. So if it's bad for electric utilities, it's going to be really messy for the other sectors.
Let me start off with a little story first, if I might. And it's the story of the way the medical plan in England developed. And they call it path dependence. So the English medical system didn't grow out of policies at all. It developed during the Second World War when people were going to the country and people were being wounded in the cities, and they set up this makeshift as-need medical system. And then it got a path and stayed that way. And I'm wondering, in a sense, if you are not on a path, but yet there are other ones out there that might be better. You talk about the conflicts in state areas. The way to look at all the things that are going on, and rather than looking at competition, but general new model that embraces all the diversity, and you look at that as, you know, the struggle of the states, maybe there's a way to embrace that into a common plan using a different model than you're presenting. You follow that, or is it too abstract?
It's abstract. I don't know what the other model is. But as I said before, for a while I had this hope that something like that would occur, that Competition will come from the bottom up, and as we get a disparate patchwork of policies, at some point the great rationalizer will step in and kind of make them coherent and connected to one another. And increasingly, I'm concerned that that's actually not going to happen, that even if we do get in place a federal policy, that we'll continue to have this proliferation of other things. And I don't see what the model is that causes the other things to converge to something that makes sense in a totality.
Tom, in listening to your talk, I'm struck by always having had this idea that economics kind of started first and you got the best solution that economics would tell you should try to put into place. And in listening to you, I almost wonder if there needs to be a paradigm shift and that we shouldn't start with economics, that we should start with the other things that make possible solutions maybe possible, and then have economics say, and that one is the best, given that you said so much we don't get the best possible solution. In other words, economics really is the dismal science.
I'm not 100% sure I follow that, but I mean, I don't think our world progresses in a fashion where economists go to politicians, tell them the right thing to do, and then politicians just muck it up. I mean, they usually just don't listen. But, you know, sometimes economists are just way behind the curve. You know, there are a lot of new things developing in the area of environmental governance that economists are starting to study now, but by no means could claim credit for having created. On the other hand, there are basic, simple economic ideas that places like Resources for the Future have been pushing for 30 or 40 years, say permit trading. And it took years and years for environmentalists and politicians to accept that permit trading might actually make sense. So I think it works differently in different kinds of policy settings.
Tom, you spoke about the feed-in tariffs and the success, I guess, that we would look at Germany. In regard to the feed-in tariff, do you quantify the fact that now you would have distributed generation, you wouldn't require transmission lines on the basis that other technologies might, and the fact that just an EIR may not be required because you can do these on rooftops? I mean, there seem to be things that, with a feed-in tariff, the benefits that are not maybe being calculated in that I think are a necessary factor.
Some of those things could be relevant. I think most households that are feeding into the grid are not able to supply their complete electricity needs, which means they still have to be on the grid, so you're not saving anything in the distribution link to them.
I was thinking particularly of commercial settings, industrial commercial rooftops, large spaces that could create up to a megawatt, which I think is a niche that has not been addressed in California for one of those. The feed-in tariffs that have been offered are too low to incentivize this type of construction of solar farms on rooftops. Not your 1 or 2 kilowatts, but actually going up into the megawatt range. And that's, I would hope, is the next opportunity to be considered.
Yeah, it's complex to assess those things. You know, if you're going to have a large-scale solar installation, then you ask the question, is that enough to serve your own needs, or are you thinking that maybe you help to serve the needs of the rest of the community? In which case, again, you need to be tied into the grid. And you know, I know some people who advocate small-scale distributed wind, so they want to have wind towers on everybody's house. And I actually think there's a significant environmental impact question associated with that. So I think you're raising some very interesting dimensions, but I don't know how to weigh them in, you know, a summary fashion.
I look at this probably from more a lawyer's perspective, and recognizing that we are trying to effectuate a policy change or a particular goal in an environment where we have a multitude of existing restrictions in your language. But what always strikes me when we get into these dialogues about models in the economic sense is that it doesn't seem to me that there is a common agreement on what the desired social benefits are. So in other words, what we're talking about is an intersection of a private market model in many cases with an intent or need to achieve a multitude of public benefits, not just carbon reduction. Yet our systems, which we are saddled with, in effect, if you want to look at it that way, fundamentally don't necessarily match up to that. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on how one might begin to look at matching up the myriad of social effects, especially when you start getting into big issues like world trade, because every time we end up in discussions about environmental issues, we end up with WTO issues. And I think that those are issues where our economic theory perhaps hasn't been pushed far enough, or no one's wanted to talk about it. And I was wondering what your thoughts were, whether it's not pushed far enough or it's just no one wants to talk about it.
Several dimensions. One, when you think about economic analysis, you can do it on a positive basis rather than a normative basis, in the sense that you can analyze all of the impacts of a collection of policies and compare them. So if you think there are 10 relevant social dimensions of something, economic analysis can help you identify the impacts of each collection of policies. It starts to proliferate and become hard to assess those. And in my mind, once we start having lots of different people put forward, well, here's my idea of what we ought to be doing, rent-seeking very quickly slips right back into the process. Not to say we shouldn't consider multiple goals, but we start moving toward the world of earmarks when that kind of thing happens. But you can do it. There's no fundamental reason why we can't do that sort of analysis. When it comes to the WTO, I think legal issues are really critical there in terms of what exactly can one country impose as a border adjustment. Maybe that's well understood legally. In my mind, it's a little bit fuzzy. And then you get into these complicated questions of, could you trigger a trade war? So then you've got this kind of escalating political notion that you have to take into account. And that one's very hard to predict. So to some extent, I think we're just limited in how much we know.
So one benefit of this program is that Tom will be here the next 2 weeks. So he's teaching a course, and other people that want to speak with him can arrange to do so. So I want to thank you today and look forward to more interactions.
All right.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.